Welcome to our Changing the Narrative podcast, where we engage in thought-provoking conversations about housing, homelessness, and community with local and national experts. I'm Anne Miskey, President and CEO of Union Station Homeless Services. Today's episode is entitled, "The Rent is Too Damn High, The Cost of Housing and Homelessness." Today, I will be talking with our esteemed guests about the reality of why the shortage of affordable housing is the number one reason for the increase in people experiencing homelessness. We're also going to talk about the urgent need for innovative solutions to address this crisis. Our first guest, as Vice President of Public Policy, Sarah Sadian oversees the National Low Income Housing Coalition's broad congressional portfolio. Welcome, Sarah, to our program today.
Thank you for having me.
Our next guest, Sarah Hunter, is a senior behavioral scientist and professor at the Party Rand Graduate School and director of the Rand Center on Housing and Homelessness in Los Angeles. And welcome, Sarah, to the program.
Thanks for inviting me.
So there are many myths out there about why we're seeing the rise of homelessness. We hear often that it's things like addiction or mental health crisis that's causing this rise in homelessness. We know, however, that this is a misperception, but in fact, the real cause of homelessness is the fact that the cost of housing is just too damn high. So I'd like to start our conversation talking about wages and how wages across the country and here in California affect the housing crisis. Sarah S., let me throw this over to you. Do you have any insights about the wage-housing crisis relationship?
What we've seen is that the primary cause of the housing crisis and homelessness is really this widening gap between incomes and what housing costs, and a severe shortage of housing that's affordable to people with the very lowest incomes. Over the last year, rents have skyrocketed. We're seeing eviction filings that are surpassing pre-pandemic levels, and homelessness is increasing as a result. For example, in California, we put out a report every year. It's called the Out of Reach Report. It looks at how much would you have to earn in order to afford a modest one-bedroom or two-bedroom apartment at fair market rent. So these are modest apartments, not luxury units. Well, in California, a full-time worker would have to earn about $42 and a quarter an hour just to afford a modest two-bedroom apartment. But we know that many of the jobs that are in California and many of the jobs across the country are paying much less than what is needed to afford those homes. This is a structural issue. So it's important that we're thinking about homelessness and the solutions in a structural way, too.
And of course, it's not just housing. It's all the other things have gone up as well. But if any of us have been into a grocery store lately, the sticker shock is pretty intense. And then we have car insurance and all of those things. So we talk a lot about affordable housing. We also need livable wage jobs. Another stat that I think is really interesting is that the California Housing Partnership estimates that over 500,000 low-income renter households in LA County do not have access to an affordable home. And one thing happens, their car dies, and their choice is, do I fix my car so I don't lose my job, but then I can't pay my rent? So the number of people who are just sort of eking out those monthly payments is a growing number of people.
And we've seen there's research that suggests if you give someone just a little cash when that crisis hits, that a few thousand dollars can prevent someone from becoming homeless. And once someone experiences homelessness, the costs to society are just much higher. So even if you take into account the cost of the supportive housing, people are no longer using the emergency room. They're no longer requiring long hospital stays, cycling in and out of the jail once they move into housing. So we know as a society, it would make more sense to just provide the supportive housing than to do nothing.
The longer we leave people on the streets unhoused, the trauma of that is so intense. And that affects people in ways that if we could get people housed quickly when they lose their housing, the cost on society and especially the cost on those individuals is so much less. The longer people are on the street, the bigger barriers, the more trauma, the more illness, everything. And then to try to help people becomes even harder. So we need to create a system where we get people back into housing as soon as possible is going to solve a lot of the issues we're dealing with right now.
Okay, let's change gears for a second and talk about one of the biggest myths about homelessness, and that is that it is mostly caused by mental health and addiction. Sarah H., can you tackle that for us?
Sure. So if you look more broadly at who has a substance use and or mental health disorder, the rates are just as high in the housed population as they are in the homeless population. So people observe homelessness, and it's those that are going through crisis that are most salient. And so people correlate those two things together, but they in fact don't co-occur. People are more likely to experience these crises if they have a mental health or substance use disorder on the streets because they don't have access to care. So if you have a stable home, you have access to medications, access to care, then you're less likely to have these extreme events. So that's important to know. Also, it's important to note that study after study has shown, including research conducted here in Los Angeles, that it's more expensive to let someone linger on the streets than to provide them with a home.
And it's more effective. It works. Criminalizing people doesn't work. Even if it was way more expensive, but it was highly successful, you could go, okay, but we've tried it for decades and the numbers just exploded when we turned to an idea of saying, if you have an affordable home and we support you, it is successful. It works. And it is a fraction of the cost. So we have to get over sort of moral judgment and look at what works for everybody. So with that in mind, are there any solutions out there, say, on the federal level or on the state level?
What's interesting, I think, about the housing crisis is that the solutions aren't unknown. It's just that the solutions that we have aren't funded anywhere at the scale that's needed. So, for example, one of the best ways to help keep people stably housed is to provide them with rental assistance that can make up the difference between what they can afford in rent and what their rent is. But because Congress doesn't put enough funding into that program, only 1 in 4 people who are eligible get any sort of help whatsoever. And the rest are left scraping dollars together every month to make sure that they're paying their rent, but at the expense of medications, nutritious food, saving for a rainy day.
And imagine what that would be like if we apply that to our Social Security benefits or our Medicaid and Medicare benefits, and the majority of people don't get the benefit that they're eligible for. How people would be suffering. But we seem to be okay of only allowing this benefit to work like a lottery. So if we could scale up this program to meet the need, we would see less homelessness and doubling up for sure.
That is a wonderful point. And again, I think it comes down to politics and this moral idea that, you know, if you're retiring, you deserve it. If you're homeless, you don't.
Yeah, it's a very convenient excuse if you can blame the people who need help rather than addressing those underlying conditions that are leading to them needing help. I'd love to add on the second major solution is building more housing supply that's affordable to people with the lowest incomes. In Los Angeles, we've found that for every 100 low-income renters, there are only 20 homes that are affordable and available to them. So that just shows there's this huge market failure that's not reaching, not serving people with the lowest incomes. And that's the place where the federal government really needs to step in as a partner to provide resources through public housing, through the Housing Trust Fund, through other resources to make sure we're addressing that market failure.
And that's a really good point that we need to be thoughtful about these vouchers, because if we just dumped all these vouchers on the market without building enough housing, we would be in trouble. Because during the pandemic was one example where, because of the high cost of housing, a lot of those emergency vouchers weren't used in Los Angeles because it was still hard for people to find housing where they could apply that subsidy. So we need to continue to support initiatives to spur development.
This is a huge issue where we have people that do have a housing subsidy, which is regular, guaranteed payment, all of those things, but landlords don't want to take them, often again because of myths and also because of discrimination. We can't talk about the issue of affordable housing and homelessness without talking about the issue of housing discrimination. Would either of you like to make a comment on that, what you've seen, and possibly what are some things that we can do?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you raised this, because the racial disparities in terms of who's most impacted by the housing crisis and by homelessness is really clear. where we disproportionately see people of color and especially Black households are most impacted by the housing crisis. And that's because of overlapping racism embedded throughout our housing systems, our employment systems, our health systems, and sort of all comes to fruition at once. I do think that there's a lot that we can do. There is no one solution. And I appreciate Sarah H. bringing this up, that we have to be doing a lot of different things at the same time. But one thing that we could do is see the federal government ban discrimination on the basis of source of income, which essentially would prevent landlords from discriminating against households that have a housing voucher. We often see that it's a proxy for racial discrimination. Landlords will say that, no, I just don't want to comply with the program, but really it's about not serving people of color. But I think we need to also be thinking about a whole host of ways throughout our housing system to be addressing racial equity. And that means thinking about how we design programs differently, incorporating people with lived experience in our policy development and analysis, and looking at ways to address this power imbalance that exists between landlords and renters. So things like access to counsel, just cause eviction standards, those are the sort of tools that we can be using to try to right this system that's off kilter.
Yes, it's also about changing people's perceptions and views. And we do a lot of work working directly with landlords and really talking their language, but building a relationship of trust where we kind of become the broker and then we introduce our clients to them. We are there to help and support both the landlord and the client. And we have found that our landlords' views change with the experience. You know, one of our landlords said the statement, "I wish all of my tenants had the service provider like you so that when there's an issue, I could call and I don't have to go through this long process." I also am kind of curious about something that is a recent and painful memory for most of us, and that is COVID. What was the impact of that? We know some of the emotional, physical, all of those things with COVID, but in terms of housing affordability, how did that affect things?
Yeah. One of the places where I think was really positive coming out of COVID was that you really saw for the first time the federal government harness its resources at the scale that we really haven't seen before. And we really saw a huge impact in those resources, emergency money to shelter providers and servicers. Millions of households received emergency rental assistance and were able to avoid eviction. In fact, evictions were at the lowest level that we've seen on record. But the flip side is that after the pandemic was moving away, some of those protections have expired. And so we're seeing sort of a rebound of this housing crisis with inflation and the higher costs. But I think it does show you what's possible when you have the political will to take really bold action. And we just need to build that political will for long-term permanent solutions, not just emergency solutions when there's a crisis happening.
Thank you. Well said. Okay. One of the big issues we deal with as well is NIMBYism. Not in my backyard when it comes to affordable housing. And we can't talk about the issue of creating housing without that. Sarah H., would you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. First, I think homeowners in the LA area are very protective of the nest egg they have built based on the value of their home. And the fact that we have this extreme housing shortage creates this perverse incentive that the ones that are fortunate to own a home, that home value has been exaggerated by the reduced supply of housing in our region. And they've become de facto millionaires, essentially, as a result of the crisis. As a result, people see it as a financial gamble to address homelessness in their neighborhood. But the funny thing is, the research doesn't support that argument. Studies have shown that supportive housing development does not reduce home price values, and we need to arm the public with better information and fight this misinformation campaign that are rampant about these issues. We need to deploy better communication and build community awareness about what works and what doesn't work. We also need to be more transparent about the current work that's underway. The general public has little information about the sheer number of people that are helped every day. Instead of focusing on the tragedies, I think we need to uplift these success stories, which are many.
Absolutely. And we need to do a much better job. I totally agree. Sarah S., did you want to address this?
It's such a hard thing to push back on. And the only thing that I've really seen works is when people understand that their fate is tied to other people in their community, and that if we are constantly restricting housing from being built, affordable housing or other housing, then it means that all of us are going to be seeing higher prices, more homelessness. Folks in our community who work in the jobs that we rely on aren't going to be able to live nearby. So I think we need to be talking about this in a holistic way, and to make it clear to folks that by building more housing, it actually makes things a lot better for all of us. If we can imagine more walkable communities, more access to transit, I want to take the bus to work or the metro to work. That sort of thing benefits everybody. And I think we need to be thinking about and selling that to our friends and family that way too.
We need the research, we need the data that both of you bring, but you also bring a real heart and a real commitment to creating good communities for all of us. So thank you. It has been a pleasure to talk with both of you today. To further explore these issues, check out our show notes, where we have included links to the National Low Income Housing Coalition and to the RAND Center on Housing and Homelessness in Los Angeles. If you want to support Union Station Homeless Services in our fight to end homelessness, please go to our website at unionstationhs.org. Thank you for joining us and listening to this amazing episode. I encourage you to subscribe and listen to all our episodes and help us change the narrative about homelessness in our neighborhoods. Together, we can be the solution we want to see in our communities. This podcast is produced by Brenda Lynch and Katie Cookerley-Dietrich, edited by Jesse Lumen, with production assistance and music by Colin Feldman. Special thanks to our Union Station Homeless Services Lived Expertise Advisory Panel, or LEAP, for their insights. Thank you.